Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A high school education consists of more than reading, writing, and arithmetic. Hopefully, you learn a little about ethics, too. Perhaps enough to share with the lenders who will help put you through college. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tessa Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Wednesday, the 18th of April. First came the allegations of sweet stock deals for financial aid officers and an official at the Department of Education. Then stories about banks trolling through private student records in search of new customers. Well, today, key Democratic congressional leaders said enough. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports on demands that the Department of Education make immediate changes to the federal student loan program.
Late last night, the Department of Education shut down lender access to its national student loan database. The department was worried unscrupulous banks had been sifting through the confidential data and using it to aggressively market high-interest loans.
This program has had little or no oversight over 6 years.
Congressman George Miller is chairman of the House Education and Labor Committee. He says the program's administrators were already under fire for failing to stop private lenders from, quote, bribing financial aid officers in exchange for student loan business.
This is a case where, you know, people are working hard to borrow money on behalf of their children, or students are borrowing, and then they're working real hard for years later to pay back these loans. And to have essentially a corruption surtax charged to them is outrageous. It's just outrageous.
Today, in an attempt to root out corruption, Miller asked the Department of Education to take several additional steps, including imposing an immediate moratorium on so-called preferred lender lists at universities. But not everyone sees the need for drastic action. Mark Kantrowitz is publisher of FinAid.org, a website that helps students find loans.
Getting rid of preferred lender lists could potentially do more harm than good.
Kantrowitz says without these lists, many students would be operating in the dark. Instead, he says shining a bright light of disclosure will clean up the industry without hurting students. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Corporate negotiations are often like a game of chicken. I'll give you this much for your company. Can't give you more, I swear. Sorry, gotta pony up. But, oh, okay. Bain Capital Partners and Thomas H. Lee Partners said for months that $37.60 a share was the best they could do to buy Clear Channel Communications. Shareholders in the media giant were set to vote on the deal tomorrow. Today, like magic, the private equity giant said, okay, $39 a share. Lisa Napoli looks at whether $1.40 will cinch the deal.
Clear Channel shareholders haven't been thrilled with the bid that was already on the table. High-stakes institutional investors like Fidelity and the California Public Employees Retirement System have thumbed their noses at the deal. Now, with this new 11th-hour offer, Clear Channel's stalling for time. The vote's been delayed until May 8th. Analyst David Joyce of Miller Tabak says that's a sign the sweetened deal may not be sweet enough.
The company giving itself another couple weeks until the official vote to try to get investors to perhaps change their votes positively to accept the deal is still going to require a lot of the marketing on their part.
Some Clear Channel investors have said they'd like to command $40 a share, but analyst Carmi Levy says just because you think you're worth more doesn't mean you'll get it.
Truth of the matter is, are they going to get that price from anyone else? Short answer is no. So if you're an investor, you kind of have to look at offers that you have versus offers that you want.
By most outsiders' math, a deal worth $27 billion total isn't something to sniff at. Whatever price Clear Channel commands, it's clear who'll get rich. The family dynasty behind Clear Channel stands to make a bundle in taking the company private. Plus, they'll get to keep their jobs, too. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Negotiations aren't any easier when it comes to politics. Today, a bill to allow Medicare to negotiate cheaper drug prices failed in the Senate. Democrats couldn't muster enough votes to break a Republican filibuster and close debate. But as Helen Palmer reports from the health desk at WGBH, that doesn't mean the bill is history.
When Democrats took control of Congress last year, they vowed to fix Medicare Part D, the senior drug benefit, and sweep away the rule that prevents government from negotiating lower prices. But today, the Democratic broom hit a partisan wall.
This is about, should the marketplace do it better, or can government do it better?
Bob Leshefsky of Health Policy and Strategy Associates says Republicans argued the bill would have ushered in price controls. Democrats countered the plan would have cut drug costs.
Republicans could point to the success of the Part D program, but at the same time, Democrats could point to the fact that prices, in many cases, are still much higher than they are in Europe or Canada.
Consumer advocates say the drug industry pulled out all the stops to protect those higher prices. Drew Nannis of the seniors group AARP says the pharmaceutical lobby, Pharma, led the charge with their dollars.
Pharma has been working against this bill pretty much from the beginning. It's purchased ads. And as you guessed, pharmaceutical manufacturers have given more than $20 million in campaign contributions just for the last two election cycles.
Senators who sponsored the bill also blame the insurance lobby for today's defeat. But Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden says he's undeterred.
This is a fight in the days ahead between whether or not we're going to do everything possible to make sure seniors and taxpayers get a fair shake under the Medicare laws, or we just kind of let the special interests have their way.
Wyden vows this bill will be back. He predicts seniors are going to see their costs under the Part D benefit rise sharply in coming months. Then they'll be back on the phone to their senators, and he's sure there'll be the 60 votes to pass the bill. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, an all-time high. Details when we do the numbers. The awfulness at Virginia Tech continued today as authorities revealed the gunman had a history of violent and bizarre behavior. Monday's mass shootings have prompted many politicians, citizens, and commentators to discuss anew the debate over gun control in this country. Robert Reich is one of them.
In the United States, if you're seriously depressed, you can purchase antidepressive drugs, but only if you have a prescription from a doctor. Antidepressants are enormously beneficial to millions of people, but they're also potentially dangerous if used improperly. So you have to see a doctor and get an assessment before you can go to a drugstore and purchase one. But in the United States, in places like Virginia, a seriously depressed or deranged person can walk into a store and buy a semi-automatic handgun and a box of ammunition. All you need is two forms of identification. You don't need permission from a doctor or a counselor or anyone in the business of screening people to make sure they're fit to have a gun. We can debate the relative benefits and dangers of antidepressants and semi-automatic handguns, but if 30,000 Americans were killed each year by antidepressants, as they are by handguns, it seems likely that antidepressants would be even more strictly regulated. So why aren't handguns? Well, the politics. Years ago, it was illegal to advertise prescription drugs. Now, due in part to Big Pharma's clout, our airwaves and magazines are filled with images of happy people who weren't until their physician prescribed a pill. But Big Pharma still hasn't been able to cut out the physician altogether because the process for screening people before they can buy an antidepressant is just too important. By contrast, the National Rifle Association, with more organization and money than even Big Pharma, has eliminated almost all screening measures for buying guns. In recent years, the NRA has even shielded gun dealers from liability. Not even Big Pharma and the powerful American Medical Association have managed to shield doctors from liability. Look abroad, and you have another useful point of contrast. In the United States, many people who are seriously depressed can't afford to see a doctor, let alone get a prescription. Unlike every other advanced nation, we do not provide universal health care or ready access to mental health services. But unlike every other advanced nation, we do allow just about anyone to buy a handgun.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He was labor secretary under President Clinton. Share your thoughts at marketplace.org. Just click on contact. This week's big nor'easter was the last thing an already beleaguered farming industry needed. First, there was the California freeze back in January that devastated citrus and nut crops. And then that weird storm that hit the South a couple of weeks ago and took some of the fuzz off the peach crop. Now farmers in the wheat belt say this week's spring snowstorm could ruin that harvest. On the upside, many New England ski resorts reopened so diehard fans could have one more run down the mountain. But in Vermont, it may have been too little, too late. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Jane Lindholm explains.
Ski season in Vermont can begin as early as October, but not this year. Bob Fries owns the Bolton Valley Ski Resort in northern Vermont.
Well, the first half of the year was not good. There was warm temperatures, made it difficult to make snow, and there wasn't a lot of natural snow, so it was slim pickings.
Then Valentine's Day brought a storm that draped the naked mountains in a blanket of white powder. And the snow has continued to pile up in the second half of the season. Great for adrenaline junkies, but not for those who rely on winter tourism to make a living. In January, some retailers were behind by as much as 80%, and that kind of deficit can be impossible to make up. Vermont Senate President Peter Shumlin is well aware of the impact a bad ski season can have on the state.
For us, snow is the equivalent of the tech boom to California. I mean, it's not just skiers coming in here buying tickets and jumping on mountains. They stay in bed and breakfasts and inns. They eat in restaurants. That drives the restaurant industry. They buy second homes. That drives the whole building industry. So it's hard to estimate the impact. It is huge.
In March, the state legislature passed an emergency aid package aimed at helping out the struggling winter industry. The bill did two things. First, it released money to advertise the fact that Vermont finally had snow. And second, it allowed towns to waive the penalty for battered retailers who couldn't pay their property taxes on time. But Curtis Picard, vice president at the Vermont Chamber of Commerce, says that didn't really help.
If you're a business that's already can't pay the, say, $10,000 property tax payment to begin with, the legislature coming in and waiving a 4, 5, or 6% penalty, it's kind of too little too late for a lot of these folks.
Senate President Shumlin acknowledges that the bill was a stopgap measure. He says this season was merely the sign of things to come.
Any reasonable scientist will tell you that we're going to rise anywhere between another 2 and 3 degrees in the next 30 years. That means that New Jersey's climate is moving to Vermont in the next decade. That has tremendous implications in our economy. Ski, maple sugar making, leaf peeping, and the list goes on and on. So we are, I at least, am looking at this with a major sense of panic.
But resort owners and business people don't like to talk about climate change, and with good reason. Tourism brings in $1.3 billion to the state annually. Start telling people that Vermont's getting warmer and who's going to come visit. Bolton Valley resort owner Bob Fries says this was just an off year, pure and simple.
As long as I remember, people talk about, oh, when I was a kid, the snowfalls were so big. I think you remember the big ones. The statistics I've seen prove to me anyway that the snowfall averages really haven't changed a whole lot.
But government and business alike agree that tax breaks are not a long-term economic fix. If the tourism industry in Vermont is to prosper, they say, it must diversify, diversify, diversify.
All-season resorts.
Attract more people to Vermont year-round.
Four Seasons, I think, is definitely something that resorts we're looking at anyway and looking at more and more.
To that end, Bolton Valley Resort just built a $2 million summer wedding facility. A season like this one reminds everyone in Vermont that spreading out the economic risk, as well as the potential reward, is a savvy move no matter what the cause. And hey, Senator Shumlin says grimly, there may soon be an even bigger tourist draw.
If the Greenland ice cap and the polar ice cap melt fast enough, we might have seaside property here before long.
In Montpelier, Vermont, I'm Jane Lindholm for Marketplace.
And you can see pictures of the late but lovely Vermont winter at our homepage, marketplace.org. Coming up, a rising crisis among India's farmers.
These are the ones who commit suicides. There are not enough social security programs. There are not enough subsidies. So there is a market failure issue to protect these people.
But first, let's do the numbers. A puzzler of a day on Wall Street, blame a tanking tech sector, mixed with some very good corporate news. The Dow shrugged up 30 points, 0.25%, to close at a record high of 12,803. The Nasdaq lost 6 points, 0.25%, to finish at 2510. The S&P edged up 1 point, ending the day pretty much flat at 1472. IBM was feeling blue despite meeting Wall Street's quarterly earnings expectations. Big Blue lost 2.33%. Investors reportedly worried that the company is falling behind in the U.S. market. And a day without a BlackBerry? Many addicts of the PDA suffered major withdrawal symptoms last night when the network stalled. Research in Motion took an initial hit in the markets, but all those fanatical fans must have impressed investors. Shares beamed up 2.33%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, we have managed money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board reports its monthly index of leading economic indicators. A Senate committee takes a look at the rising number of highway fatalities. And it's particularly important not to leave someone hanging with their hand in the air tomorrow. Greet your friends, associates, and passersby with a high five for National High Five Day. Annually, the third Thursday of April. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. We mentioned in the numbers that Research in Motion's BlackBerry email devices crashed for more than 10 hours overnight. BlackBerries, also known as crackberries for the addictive and annoying behavior they spawn, were back up and running this morning. Glory be. No word on how much extra sleep and personal time the outage caused for users. Speaking of technology breakdowns, if you thought we were done talking about taxes this week, you were wrong. Last night, in addition to all those people crowding their local post office, last-minute filers using TurboTax and other software flooded computer servers. Some of them crashed and caused customers to miss the midnight deadline. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale joins us with the details. Hey, John.
Hello, Tess.
So are you one of the folks who wasn't able to do your last-minute online filing last night?
I waited pretty late, but I got mine in on Sunday, so I was not one of the ones who, turned out, didn't get confirmation yesterday that their e-filing went through when they were using TurboTax. It usually is supposed to just take minutes, and it turned out that people began yesterday learning that they weren't getting the confirmation that their tax was filed with the IRS. And I asked Intuit spokesman Harry Fortzheimer what caused the rush.
We're seeing the tax season get later and later in the year and more procrastinators. So the combination of consumers as well as accountants who, you know, would drop off batch filings for their many customers just put strains on the system.
All right. And Intuit, of course, the maker of TurboTax. What's the IRS telling people? It sounds like the IRS is actually in a forgiving mood.
They are. People who were unable to e-file yesterday using Intuit TurboTax software have until midnight Thursday, April 19th, to file their returns. This is potentially helping several hundred thousand last-minute tax filers who were affected by these server problems last night.
Is TurboTax saying anything about whether the people who weren't able to file on time will get some sort of refund from Intuit?
They're not saying that. If you've done your taxes online, calculated your taxes online, it's a one price for both filing and calculating your taxes, and it's not broken out, so there aren't refunds for that. If you use the software on your own computer, it's a $16.95 fee for filing electronically, and potentially there could be a refund of that, but they're still in the talking stages.
Well, we do hear from the IRS that they prefer all of us to use electronic filing, but of course it costs money. There are all these risks of technical problems that we've just seen. Any chance that the IRS would expand its offering of electronic filing through the agency?
Yeah, they now offer free file for taxpayers who earn less than $52,000 a year, which is 70% of all filers. But beyond that, the IRS has a policy of encouraging the private sector to innovate and develop new ways of e-filing. And so they want to keep that in the private sector, which allows companies like TurboTax to charge for e-filing.
John, do you know if we've ever waited until April 19th for a tax day? Is that the latest it's ever been?
As far as I know, that's the latest it's ever been. Even April 17th, because of the holiday in the District of Columbia, was a late filing time. It's usually, as you know, April 15th.
All right. Well, benevolence from the IRS. Who knew?
Yeah, exactly. If you were going to file late anyway, here's your "the dog ate my tax form" excuse.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome, Tess.
By the way, for those of you who still don't file on time, the tax man won't be coming after you. At least not the actual one. Mark Everson is leaving his post as IRS commissioner to lead an organization whose benevolence is in its charter. The American Red Cross announced today that Everson accepted a position as its new chief executive. This weekend, weather forecasters are supposed to give their annual monsoon predictions. In India, millions are literally praying for rain. Two-thirds of the population there are farmers. Very few of them have profited from India's booming economy. Without new farming technology or irrigation, monsoons provide critical moisture. But they've become less and less reliable, and that is driving some farmers to take desperate measures. Miranda Kennedy has this report.
The Gooday family squats on mats in a small dark room. They're cotton farmers, or at least they were. Kamla Gooday says their 4.5 acres of cotton and lentil didn't yield anything for years. Her husband owed the bank $4,000 and couldn't pay any of it back. One day he swallowed his pride and asked the bank for another loan.
The bank manager said that you'll have to mortgage or give us the land, your farm, because we can't give it to you. You haven't even paid anything of your old loan, and we cannot think of giving you another loan.
Halasram Gooday returned home, and while his family took an afternoon nap, he drank a bottle of pesticide he'd bought for his fields. He died quickly before his family could wake up. It's a familiar tale. Here in Vidarbha, a cotton-growing region of central India, thousands of farmers have killed themselves rather than bear the burden of their high-interest loans. But Palasram's debt didn't go away. It just got passed on to his son, Bhaskar, who blames it on rising costs of everything, especially the genetically modified cotton seeds made by Monsanto.
For the last couple of years, we've been spending extra money to buy these pesticides, high-yield seeds. But the seeds can't protect us against drought, and we have no irrigation in our fields. They also can't protect us from wild animals coming into our fields, and we have no money to put up fences. So there is no relief. Basically, farming is a death wish now.
The government does have a compensation program for farmers who commit suicide. The Goodet family received over $2,000. Although they have to keep 70% of the money in the bank for 5 years, some worry the program is an incentive for farmers who know they'll leave their families with something. The suicide rate among farmers here has tripled in the last decade. D.K. Joshi, an economist, says small farmers are more vulnerable than ever before.
These are the ones who commit suicide. There are not enough social security programs, there are not enough subsidies, so there is a market failure issue. And that is where the state has to step in, and state has not been able to do its job to protect these people.
In a recent national survey, 40% of farmers said they'd give it up if they could. In Vidarbha, farmers have put several entire villages up for sale. No buyers yet, but it won them some attention. Last year, India's prime minister pledged $1 billion to the region. Officials also started a grassroots campaign to try to dissuade farmers from suicide. They screened this video in village centers. It opens with a woman mourning her husband's suicide.
Melane sang tujha to prashna sutla ka uthla hi samasyecha.
But it gets more uplifting when another farmer's wife convinces her drunk and indebted husband not to kill himself. The moral of the story is that farmers should diversify into small rural businesses like raising cattle. Bhaskar Gore bought a pair of bulls with the compensation money. They should bring in cash because he rents them out to other farmers. But there's nothing here for the animals to graze on after 4 years of drought. The government has promised to build irrigation canals, but they won't be finished before this spring's planting season. Bhaskar is far from certain that his crops will yield anything this year, so he says he needs to do daily wage labor to survive. As the sun goes down, he and his mother work together silently, harvesting chickpeas for some other farmer to sell. In Vidarbha, India, I'm Miranda Kennedy for Marketplace.
And we have photos of the people and places in Miranda's story. They're on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Understanding the advantage of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by the important new book, Speaking of Faith, by public radio host Krista Tippett, in bookstores everywhere now. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, a story you don't hear often about the American car industry. Today, Chrysler announced plans to build two new plants in Michigan and upgrade three others. It'll cost nearly $2 billion. But Chrysler's still going to tally a net job loss of 1,400 jobs. Blame the robots. The new plants will rely on more automation. Meanwhile, Chrysler's parent company, Daimler Chrysler, continues to talk to potential buyers about selling off the U.S. unit. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow hit a new record high, up 30 points, 0.25% to 12,803. The Nasdaq fell 6 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 rose 1 point to close pretty much flat. Our engineers include Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, and Joel Stein. Next time, 400 stores, a roller coaster, hotels, dining, still bored.
As hard as it is to believe, there's not quite enough to do at Mall of America.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.